picture with me, a cartoon from the New Yorker magazine, February 1st edition. A man with a hint of an emerging middle age paunch just above his belt affects the stance of a general who has just won a great victory. The way his feet are planted signals his claim to the territory he has just conquered. Fisted hands on his hips, head held high. All around him, there is an aura of light, like Jesus on the Mount of the Transfiguration. And the caption reads, Gary basks in the glow of a 15-minute window with no empty cardboard boxes in the house. Gary, the Marie Kondo of COVID and my personal hero. Remember Marie Kondo and her housekeeping hermeneutic? Does this spark joy? According to the Gospel of Marie Kondo, a life tidied is a life changed. All you need to achieve transformation is to go through the stuff in your house, item by item, asking the question, does this spark joy? Beginning with her 2014 bestseller, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying, Marie Kondo has built herself a decluttering empire, the net worth of which, some say, is on track to exceed $11 billion this year. COVID has been very good to Marie Kondo. For 12 months, we have been forced to spend more time inside our homes with few, if any, people and lots of stuff. So what a blessing to have this external voice whispering, you go, girl. When was the last time you used that or wore that or wanted to sit in that chair? How many throw pillows does one couch need? And even if that one was needle-pointed by great Aunt Mimi, does it spark joy? Yet even as stuff goes out the door, new stuff is streaming in. COVID has also been very good to Amazon and the manufacturers of cardboard and bubble wrap. I mean, with just a click of a button, I can buy anything. And who doesn't need the joy of those cute little Marie Kondo bamboo sake cups for $50 a pair? Would it surprise you to learn that BMK, that is before Marie Kondo, in first century Palestine, there was a young itinerant teacher who made quite a stir, preaching a gospel of radical decluttering. Admittedly, with very mixed results when it came to empire building. The gospel of decluttering, according to Jesus, according to John, chapter 2, beginning at verse 13. The Passover of the Jewish people was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Went up. From where? Just prior to today's story, Jesus, Mary, and a few friends have spent a couple of days in Capernaum, maybe as guests of Simon Peter, who, according to a recent reading from Mark's gospel, had a home there with his wife and mother-in-law. More importantly, before the Capernaum stopover, Jesus, mother, Mary, and friends went to a wedding in Cana. You know what happened at Cana. The marriage feast had barely begun and the wine ran out. Thanks to some maternal arm twisting, Jesus averts social catastrophe by transforming water into enough wine to keep every Cana wedding banquet going strong for the foreseeable future. Now here in today's gospel, only a few verses later, Jesus on his own decides to stage a decluttering demonstration in the heart of Jerusalem, just as the city is consumed with pre-Passover preparations. Quick sidebar. While our gospel writer John tells us that the clutter Jesus encounters is in the temple, currency exchangers and livestock vendors were assigned a space in the temple's forecourt. And that whole forecourt of the temple was about 25 acres, which is about half the size of the Boston Common. And the area reserved for the exchange of unclean foreign currencies into temple shekels and the purchase of unblemished creatures for temple sacrifice was a much smaller space, roughly comparable to that area across the street from our state house, the place where smaller demonstrations tend to gather. Now, all four gospels include an account of the so-called cleansing of the temple. But where the reports of Matthew, Mark, and Luke are placed near the very end of the gospels and are short enough to be tweeted, John paints a much more vivid picture and puts it intriguingly at the very beginning, in the second chapter. And only in John's account does Jesus make a whip of cords. What I'm finding underscored here is the intentionality of what Jesus is doing. Fashioning such an instrument of disruption would take some time and forethought. So what, I wonder, went through Jesus' mind as his hands worked on making that whip? Maybe the words of a prophet like Amos, as it is written in chapter 5, "Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the offerings of well-being of your fatted calves, I will not look upon, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." Or perhaps instead of concentrating on the clutter, Jesus' mind may have been set on all that the clutter tragically obscures, namely gifts like those extolled by the psalmist in today's psalm, Psalm 19, where we hear the fear of the Lord, that is, fear as in an uncluttered focus on God's abundance, the kind of focus one devotes to a lover, that is clean and endures forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than any gold, more than much fine gold, sweeter far than honey in the comb. Or maybe as Jesus wove multiple strands together, Jesus was of many minds, angry as a prophet and aching as a mother hen seeking to scatter, to gather her scattered brood. Having made a whip of cords, the gospel says, Jesus drives all of them out of the temple, both sheep and cattle, and also pours out the coins of the money changers and overturns their tables. Can we agree that cleansing is a misnomer? Sheep and cows, scared poopless, and with that aftermath mingled with the coins bearing the profiles of rulers from every corner of the known world. And what about those dove sellers? For them, it appears Jesus holsters the whip, yet singles them out for a verbal rebuke. Take these things out of here. Stop making my Father's house a marketplace, a place of trade. What is it about the doves that draws Jesus' special attention? Until now, I had never really stopped to wonder about that. The dove sellers provide the last sacrificial option for the poor. Apparently, doves were cheap and plentiful. At the same time, Jesus does have a special relationship with at least one dove, the embodiment of God's loving spirit that descends on Jesus in the Jordan River. To see doves being sold for sacrifice, especially to the poor, of all the possible trades, would this for Jesus perhaps be the most heart-piercing? So stop. Stop making my Father's house a place of trade. My Father's house. What's interesting here is the word house, or in Greek, oikos. So on the one hand, we have the Father's house, God's home, God's oikos. And then the marketplace, the place of trade, even though place is a translation of the same word, oikos, usually for referring to homes. Translations are always interpretations. And here, in the judgment of translators, when you put imperium, that word for trade, together with oikos, well, that's a place, but not a home. Stop making God's house a home of trade? No. In God's house, especially in the home of the God who will raise the crucified Jesus from the dead, there is no room for debits and credits. God's house, as Jesus will speak of that in the 14th chapter of John, is a house with many dwelling places, many rooms for life, for God's beloved, to live eternally, which that eternity is beginning now. So stop. Stop cluttering up God's living room with what is transactional. Doves and all creatures whom God's spirit embraces deserve better. Now, here it's important to note the biggest difference in the way John tells the story compared with Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that's the group we call the Synoptic Gospels. Like in John, Jesus says what God's house is not for. A hangout for the worst kinds of deal makers in the Synoptic Gospels. A den of thieves who demand your money or your life. But in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus also is heard to say what God's house is for, namely prayer. God's is a house of prayer. Now in John, when the crowd demands to see Jesus' credentials, Jesus says, destroy this temple, and in 3 days, I will raise it up, which does nothing to clarify the rightful purpose of God's house, or does it? God's meaning is totally lost on most of the crowd, who go down that ever popular rabbit hole of a construction project that has taken forever. The renovation of the second temple was begun by Herod the Great in 20 BCE. If you kind of want to guess how old Jesus was at this time, it is about 46 years, and still it is unfinished. But Jesus, our narrator tells us, was talking about the temple of the body, Jesus' body, as if to say, watch this space, my space. Watch and you will know where to find a place to be at home with God, a place that is radically uncluttered, where belovedness is a gift, and where everything that gets in the way of that God will discard. God's house, embodied in Jesus, a home wherever a home is needed, a place where there is dying to stuff and rising to real life. That dying and rising, the central expectation for much more than the life-changing magic of tidying. Watch this space, says Jesus. Watch me. It's as if the gospel, according to John, begins with an invitation to join Jesus on a very special kind of house tour. For from now on, wherever Jesus goes, there will be decluttering. Living space will get cleared of death's debris, and fresh breathing room will be created. Just as that good is dead wedding banquet got revived, there will be healing, even a man born blind. There will be feeding, even a crowd of 5,000. There will be resurrections, even a man dead in his tomb for 4 whole days. The disciples, as we read toward the end of today's gospel, verse 21, will only begin to understand that this is how God's house works. Months, a couple years later, after Jesus is raised from the dead. Today, like the followers of Jesus in every age, we are also slow to learn, and yet the door to God's house remains open. Open with no key ever necessary. And any clutter that we would try to bring in, the spirit of the living Christ is chucking out the back door. For there is no room for clutter in God's house, no room for hate in God's house, no room for any of the other deadly conditionalities of you must be this, but never that, in order to be loved by God. In God's house, as that house, that space is made visible in Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, there are no turnstiles or transactions, no showcases or display tables. Spaciousness, the spaciousness of unconditional love, not spotlessness, is the point. Living space, a home with room for grief and lament, anger and confusion, honesty and doubt, conflict and reconciliation, recreation and yes, yes, joy. God's house, where God demonstrates decluttering again and again and again in order to make sure that there is always room for us to turn. And that turning is what we'll sing about right now. It is the canticle of the turning. It is the song of giving over clutter to God and with one's body, with Christ, singing and dancing.